Okay, we are recording. This is the Stack Exchange Podcast, worst episode ever. But today's Stack Exchange Podcast features Jeff Atwood, your not-so-special guest, and I'm Joel Spolsky. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And we're here with Stack Exchange Podcast, episode number six.
That's right.
Hey, Jeff. This is also an experiment, which explains a little bit of our hysterical confusion here. For the first time ever, there are a few live listeners who are able to tune in using the Ustream. But then I can't look at the computer. Okay. All right. Well, here's what I'll do. How's that?
There you go.
Okay. This is kind of odd. How does Leo do this?
Leo has a boom arm that drops it down in front of him.
Oh, okay.
Joel needs one of those boom arms. I see this coming.
Boom arm. Sign me up for a boom arm. So, Jeff, what's new this week?
Well, the first thing I want to mention was I was thinking the old podcast we did.
Yeah.
Like, it ends up being an interesting record of, like, why we did the things we did at the time we did them, because I've kind of forgotten a lot of that stuff now.
I know. And the trouble is it's all like in audio format, which is like 86 hours of work if you wanted to listen to it all and try to get some benefit out of it.
The show notes are pretty good. I mean, I can usually hone in and find that, but I guess it's sort of the object lesson is if you're doing something like this and you want to have a podcast, even if only 10 people ever listen to it,
mm-hmm.
it's kind of useful for you to introspect on like your own actions and like why you made those crazy decisions 3 years ago that you don't really remember all the reasons behind it now.
Because God knows that a comment in the code would be too much to ask for.
Well, it's part of the story, you know, and I mean, we have kind of, I know these aren't really social sites in that sense, but there's a very strong community aspect to them and showing sort of the track record of why you did things and how you did things is kind of important. I mean, I'm reading this book now that Brad Burnham turned me on to called Super Cooperators. And he starts with, I'm only about 20% into it, but he gets in, he starts with, this guy is sort of a hardcore researcher. I don't know his exact background.
Oh, no.
He's a real scientist with math and computer simulations. And he's focusing on the prisoner's dilemma, which,
yep.
you know, is about the paradox of, well, I won't go into the details because I'm
hoping
most people
have heard of it. It's a standard problem from game theory, yep.
Yeah, it's like, do you help or harm the other person? You know, and both people have to make a decision, and do you reach an equilibrium? And so he's doing a lot of research about that. And one thing he found was that the reason, if you view it as like a lab experiment where you have this one interaction, then it's kind of artificial because that's not how society works. That's not how people work.
Right.
People remember when
yes.
you sort of fail them.
Yes. And they punish you.
Right. And the funny thing is, and I read this in another book too, this concept of vengeance, like it seems really negative. It's like, okay, if you cross me, I'm going to get you.
Yep.
You know,
an eye for an
eye. But it turns out,
tooth for a
without that,
cigar.
You get some bad behaviors too. Like it turns out vengeance, within reason, obviously. If you have a vendetta where it's like, I'm going to follow you around for the rest of your life and make everything you do miserable, that's crazy. That's bad. But, you know, if you screw me on this business deal, then I'm going to try to screw you on another business deal. This sort of tit for tat thing was one of his first equilibriums, was realizing that the strategy that tends to win once you get outside the trivial, isolated chambers of prisoner's dilemma and start considering it as a chain of events. Was tit for tat, where
right.
if you do something bad to me, I'm going to do something bad to you, but not forever.
It was the tit for tat with distortion, where sometimes, because the trouble is, once you get into a retribution cycle, they will then retribute you back just for retributing them. And so the optimum strategy was tit for tat with errors, where you sometimes fail to tat or tit. Fail to tit.
That it's close. I mean, you're in the right ballpark. It sounds like. Did you read this?
Yeah, this is standard game theory stuff. This was William Poundstone wrote a book about this a while ago. That was a popularization of what is the sort of the first year textbook on game theory in any standard university game theory course.
Well, and again, I'm starting from the beginning. So this is the very beginning of the conversation about the stuff he's explaining all these theories. The thing that tends to emerge is what he calls generous tit for tat, where you sort of penalize somebody initially, but then you sort of forgive them, you know,
right.
after time. So you can come back to some equilibrium, because if you have this vengeance thing, then it's like everybody, it's eye for an eye, you know, everybody's blind.
The trouble is
doesn't really work.
The reason that tit for tat doesn't work is that you can accidentally get into a vicious cycle that never ends just to an accident. Like somebody interprets that the other party has harmed them, and then they feel obliged to punish the opposite party, and then the opposite party then they obviously feel they feel like they have to. Well, you just basically get these blood feuds that go on for centuries and centuries and centuries that might have all been set off by like an accidental misunderstanding.
Yeah, it's really interesting because that's one of the fundamental game theory problems. And the reason it applies to us, and I think the reason Brad recommended it, was because once you introduce this concept of reputation systems, mm-hmm. that really helps you not have the bad version of the prisoner's dilemma. You start to have the good version because people remember, oh, because you helped me, I'm going to help you. And then if you broaden that beyond, you know, do I even know this person? Like the concept of the Good Samaritan, like you're driving down the road, you see somebody broken down on the side of the road. Are you going to stop and help them? You'll probably never see this person ever again.
Right.
But there's this concept of reputation sort of in your head and also sort of in the broader world. It's like, even though no one may see you do this, there's still reasons that you'll do it and reasons like society will reward you for doing things like that. I mean, it gets very nebulous. I mean, you start getting beyond, you know, in a tightly knit community of people, obviously you will have a reputation that people will be, you know, gossiping and whatnot about whether you're a good person, the bad things you do, the good things you do. But on a greater societal scale, and certainly for Stack Exchange, I mean, that's the concept, right? I mean, you may or may not see these people ever again. You might be a drive-by user getting helped once. So what is the motivation for anybody to really help you?
So
and
we
this whole pay it forward thing.
That actually, that brings up the one other thing which I've been wanting to discuss, which is you know, we have these badges and hardly anybody even notices the badges. And you may wonder, like, why would somebody do something in order to earn a badge that nobody's ever going to notice? Like, does anybody really see, like, oh, John Skeet got another green spiffy smiley badge or whatever the badge is that he just earned? And some of us in the New York office here went and heard Bing Gordon, who is the head of EA, Electronic Arts, the game company, for a long time. And he gave a little talk on gamification and game theories. And one of the things he said is that people, you know, they have their outward appearance, the way they appear either in real life, like what clothing they're wearing, like how they appear to other people. But also there's their appearance on the internet, which is like what their avatar looks like and what flair they have next to their name and the little number next to their name and their little badge points and stuff like that. And they care about all that stuff. And in fact, their caring goes dramatically up if they believe that even one person has seen that badge. So if one person comments on, congratulations, you earned a badge or you earned some reputation or I really like those shoes you're wearing in real life, anything like that, just having one person comment in a positive way or negative way, just to even you know, appear to have seen something, makes you much more likely to continue doing that thing and to care about it and to believe that people are looking at it. So essentially, everybody kind of walks around on the internet thinking that everybody is noticing all of their flares and their EPIN and all whatever crap they've accumulated. And in reality, they're probably extrapolating wildly, but they do need somebody to notice it, or they need to believe that somebody has noticed it, or they won't care.
Well, this is also the rationale behind doing things in public. I mean, I observed for a long time that the worst behaviors were in sort of closed systems.
Yeah.
The more you say, look, you know, this is a public artifact, behave here in a way as you would, as if people, you know, people are watching you. You know, you don't know who they are. There might be just one person watching you, but somebody's going to be looking.
Right.
It not only encourages positive behaviors, people will see you helping another person and think better of you, but also they will see when you're mean to people. And, you know, I've said this before, but it definitely bears repeating, is meanness gets penalized heavily. That was one of my biggest surprises, was that people don't like meanness. Like, that is not something that gets rewarded and often gets penalized pretty heavily in our system. Mm-hmm. So I think that makes sense. Now, as far as extrinsic motivation, I should mention, this is an old meta post. It's meta.stackoverflow.com, question number 42481.
Right, meta.
Wow, there's some typing. And just in that previous discussion, the book I was discussing anyway is called Super Cooperators.
Wait, say that number again. 4241.
42481.
Oh, 42481.
We don't see this a lot.
Extrinsic
but it's
motivation.
It's a user, John Erickson, who sort of got disenchanted with sort of the reputation systems that we have and the badges and stuff like that. This is really rare. We don't see a lot of people. They'll just usually ignore it if they're not into it, but it's rare to hear someone make a somewhat articulate case that they thought the system was actually a negative, you know, it was actually harming their participation on the site. And I think it varies person by person. I'm not, you know, denying John his right to have this opinion about this. And I thought it was really interesting, and I read it several times just to make sure I wasn't missing anything or there's something we were doing wrong. And you know, there are certain classes of people that you can turn off with systems like this, but I think the benefits sort of outweigh massively outweigh.
There's not even that was another thing that Gordon Bing mentioned, is that there's just a certain number of people. There's actually a small number of people are directly motivated by something like having a point system with monotonically increasing points. There's a large number of people that just don't care, and there's a tiny number of people that will actually play actively, get really involved in the game. Another interesting thing he mentioned is that when you make a game, if you make it a cooperative game, almost everybody prefers that to a competitive game. And the one exception is the 18 to 24-year-old male. But pretty much everybody else prefers a cooperative game to a competitive game.
And I think we've been clear, too, that, you know, the goal here is learning. I mean, there's sort of a higher purpose to this game. It's not a game for the sake of getting you more coupons to Denny's or something like that. This is a game where the purpose is learning.
That's a purpose. Denny's?
Yeah, for you to teach other users and for other users to teach you. So you get better at this thing that presumably you value. Otherwise, why would you be there? Like on the DIY site, you're there because, wow, I really like working on my home and I want to learn how to do this. I find it a rewarding and fulfilling activity, you know. So I think because Kathy Sierra had emailed me asking about the gamification stuff, and she was actually annoyed because it was a turnoff for her.
And the game scores?
Well, just that everybody viewed it as like the magic bullet. Like it was the magic thing you add to make everything fun.
What is annoying is that it's becoming this sort of knee-jerk automatic thing that everybody slaps onto their website for no purpose without any thought.
That's what she was reacting to. Yeah. But I think what you can't capture there, and I probably should have articulated in a more clear way to her, was that you have to sort of have a higher purpose to say, yes, this is a game. This is overtly a game. Mm-hmm. But it's in service of this higher goal. You know, again, beyond coupons to Denny's. This is about making you a better person in some small way. It's something that you actually give a crap about.
Right.
Now, there are things that can be extended to, but I think you've got to start with, you know, a higher purpose. Like, this is a game to make this good thing happen.
Well, I mean, you don't have to. I mean, we like to, but you can make Zynga, and the higher purpose is nothing other than wasting time and updating your cauliflowers.
Well, right, but that's kind of evil gamification.
It's just a game. It's just a game and nothing else.
I mean, I guess it's in the sense of like gambling. Like when I go to Las Vegas, to me, is very boring because I don't really enjoy gambling. But if it's entertainment to you, if you enjoy the gambling, then yes, go there, gamble, have fun.
Right.
That's fine. If you find it intrinsically rewarding. But I think in some sense we're, you know, trying to trick users into playing the game and actually, you know, getting something useful out of it they didn't necessarily anticipate. And I don't think you're going to ever wake up one day and, wow, I learned a lot from playing World of Warcraft, right? Whereas you might actually wake up one day and say, wow, I learned a lot from participating on Stack Overflow or Serverfall, even though I didn't mean to, right? Or Farmville.
So, but wait, we're kind of a ways off from the cooperation versus the tit-for-tat competition.
Well, the cooperation part is that, you know, teaching and learning. Everybody's a teacher and everybody's a learner. In fact, there was a really good article that Jen retweeted off to put that in the show notes about the Wikipedia, how Wikipedia is sort of deconstructing the idea of experts, which I've been saying for a long time, that there really aren't pure experts. I mean, there's some continuum where you're a beginner and about everything.
This
concept, you're continually learning, like the perpetual intermediate, right? This is the concept of UI where nobody's really an expert. Everybody's just sort of muddling along in the middle.
If you were an actual expert, I think you'd be infuriated by this idea that we should just go with what the average person thinks rather than what I have spent a lifetime learning.
That's not exactly what I'm trying to say.
Let's say that you are the world's foremost expert on testing of bilingual students, and you've been studying this for 30, 40 years, and somebody writes a Wikipedia article that's just completely wrong, and people keep editing it to make it more based on common knowledge rather than based on what you have actually learned over the years. You can see how that would be a little frustrating. That sort of reminded me of, I think there's one of the Isaac Asimov books, there's a character like that who's just, where essentially the academics have devolved into just copying each other, and all they're doing is reporting on common knowledge rather than actually going out and investigating things themselves. It seems like that's where Wikipedia is going, don't you think? Where it's just like, yeah, who cares what the actual fact is? Who cares what the experts say? We're all about the crowd voting for whatever the most popular opinion is.
Well, I think it's more participatory. I mean, I think that's the there's both good and bad things about it, but I think the clear good is that it's less about discussing, you know, what might happen and just trying a bunch of crap and seeing what actually works and what doesn't. And the other thing I would remark about Wikipedia that you've seen for a long time is the most obsessive members of the community win. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this has good and bad aspects to it. But I do think that unlocking this idea that through the internet, you know, some guy in, you know, Eastern Europe who's completely obsessed with X, where so X is some useful mathematical thing, can now find an outlet for that, you know, for the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a clear good. I found the article. It's at the AWL, theawl.com. It's called Wikipedia and the Death of the Expert. I thought this was particularly well-written.
Oh, Wikipedia.
Because this is a thing that we have tension about, because Joel is always saying, you know, our sites are for experts, and ostensibly they are. I mean, we want people who know what they're doing on the sites, obviously, to lead the way. But they're also tools for people who are obsessive about this topic but and want to get better at it.
You know, we did a little study of this. We did the reciprocity study. Have we talked about this in the podcast? Because I don't want to repeat myself.
I can't remember. Give this a short version.
Short version is that we did a little study to see what percentage of people ask questions, only ask, only answer, versus doing both. And the people who both ask and answer questions in a given month are rated as, we just call them reciprocals. I don't remember why. And then we measured for each site on the Stack Exchange Network what percentage of reciprocity there was, what percentage of people both asked and answered. And the least successful sites on the network in some ways either had a very low or very high reciprocity. And the sweet spot, I think, was 14%. So there were some sites that only had 10% reciprocity, meaning there were only 10% of people that both asked and answered. And we felt like those were on the verge of becoming the kind of sites where a bunch of experts sit around and answer questions for a bunch of newbies. And in the other extreme, there was these sites that were 40-50% where 40% of the people were asking and answering. And we felt that those sites were a little bit too easy. In other words, everybody could answer any question, and they were bordering on chat rooms where everybody has an opinion and people feel free to just chime in on all kinds of stuff. And those weren't really, I mean, those are fun, but they're not successful for our format.
You certainly see a lot of focus on track record. I mean, this concept of reputation systems, because one of the key points of this article is that even if Wikipedia is wrong, you can sort of trace why it's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
There's sort of an audit trail of why, how things got to the way they are, and sort of all the discussions and everything that produced that page.
Yeah. Something just rang. Producer Alex, was that...
That was an attempt to... That was unsuccessful.
We are still attempting to raise our guest on the inner tubes. This is bizarre. I have like this gigantic microphone on my desk and a big headset, and I feel like it's like a 1920s telephone.
Well, we can mention that we're now an OpenID provider.
Oh, yeah, that's a big deal.
That's one big piece of news.
Oh, boy, that is a big deal. Let's talk about that.
I'll give you the Reader's Digest version from my perspective.
Okay, and then I'll give the completely opposite perspective.
Completely opposite. Well, Joel, first of all, Joel is a huge OpenID fan, which it says in his profile that he's a huge OpenID fan. So you know that he's a huge OpenID fan.
Oh, my God. If I have a heart attack right now, just continue the podcast without me.
Yes.
Because you might as well for all the listening you do to me.
The benefit to us is, well, we still accept all the things we accepted before, so this is additive. We're not taking anything away.
Certainly log on with Google.
Yeah, so the main benefit is there's definitely research data that shows when you send users to another site to sign up, you kick them off your site, it scares a certain percentage of users away, which makes total sense. So one of the advantages of us having this high level of integration, being our own OpenID provider, is that we don't have to send you off-site. From your perspective as a new user, you're on site X, where X is, I don't know, English.stackexchange.
Yeah.
You stay on that site, you sign up, and then you log in, and you haven't been transported to this other alien place.
Yeah, which was, in the past, it was myopenid.com, where we said, hey, want to sign up? Try this one, and then you were landed on some funny site that looked like a domain squatter of some sort.
That's right. The other issue with, although MyOpenID has generally been okay, they had a couple fairly major things go wrong recently that I was pretty unhappy about. It's not really a paid service. I mean, from Dan Rain, there's no real incentive for them to improve this service. And it's not really their fault. That's just the way it's set up. They have this other paid service that obviously they want you to sign up for.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not unreasonable to think that this service might fall into disrepair at some point and would maybe stop working,
right?
Which would be bad for us. So we now have a fallback, which we directly control, you know, which is our OpenID provider.
Right.
So those were really the main two benefits from my perspective, is the on-site sign-up and then no longer having, you know, a total dependence on my OpenID. Although I would also make the argument that I don't know who would be signing up for sites that wouldn't have a Gmail account and or a Facebook account anyway.
Well, there is a certain percentage that do that, so there you go. I mean, we have stats. They
no,
exist.
Options are good. I'm all for options. Options are good. Although, you know, you could make the argument, I think Joel has made this argument several times, is, you know, showing people options also scares them away. It's like, oh, I have to sign in, I have to pick. Do I sign in with Stack Exchange? Do I sign in with Google? Do I sign in with Yahoo? Do I sign in with my OpenID? Do I sign in with Facebook? You know, which one did I use to sign in? You know, yeah. I'm sympathetic, but I think this concept of third-party credentials, that's kind of unavoidable. Like, if you sign into some picture-sharing service with Twitter versus Facebook, you have to remember that you signed in with Twitter and not Facebook. I mean, I don't know how to avoid that.
Yeah. Audience member Michael Pryor has asked in the chat room, have there been any tests to see if there's a lower bounce rate on the sign-up page now that we have our own provider? And Kevin does have some stats, and I think he's showing that pretty much all we did is diverted the people that would have gone to MyOpenID anyway. We've pretty much diverted them to us, but it hasn't increased the number of signups as one might expect.
Well, and also the thing I kind of objected to in previous discussions about this is you don't actually have to sign up to do stuff on our site. I mean, the core action, which is asking a question or answering a question, does not require you to sign up. So you wouldn't actually be blocked. So it's kind of a weird – I think we're a little bit unusual in that regard, because on most sites, like, you can't do anything until you click register, right? I mean, you can do nothing, literally nothing.
Right.
So it's kind of a weird thing for us to measure. And, you know, I'm open to improving it. Like, you know, it can always be better. I'm not opposed to making it better.
Yay. I think that OpenID would have been awesome if it had really taken off. But given that it didn't really take off, right now, we're one of the only people that's out there pushing it. And it's been that way for a couple of years that we're still kind of, you know, at some point, when do we give up and just, you know, OpenID has just not really succeeded at what it's supposed to be for.
I think it's working well for, like, I mean, Discus for blog comments. I mean, that's, to me, is one of the big low-hanging fruits of, like, I go to your blog, won't leave a comment.
Right.
And I had written a blog entry about sort of my thinking about this, and I made a mistake in it. Like, there was some screenshot where I had some – the name of the bank was wrong. It was the ATM machine. And the guy's like, oh, he's like, you got the name of the bank wrong. It's this thing. And he's like, you know what? You're right, because I wouldn't have actually bothered to post this comment if I had to register. I mean, my point is that actually works. That's one of the big low-hanging fruits. You know, I'm not saying you should sign into your bank with OpenID. That's crazy to talk. Mostly I'm just looking at, you know, those scenarios where it's, you know, and I think you're seeing this with picture sharing services. You like logging
into this little chat that we have right here on Ustream right now, which I had to make a dumb little account for, and I've already forgotten the password for it because I auto-generated it. And
No. Those are the big
that's where it would be useful. It would be. I would love to see that. I've seen it on, well, Discus. There was one other that you mentioned that I do actually use. Oh, Hacker News.
Hacker News supports it in a very, very crappy way.
Yeah.
And the other thing we've seen is if you support it badly, that's almost
the worst.
Look at
that. Riley says he did log on to the chat with his OpenID, which is cool. I mean, I wish I figured that out. I didn't even see that. Okay.
Oh,
so you could theoretically log on to the Ustream chat with OpenID.
I found that when Joel says he tries, he doesn't try very hard. He cares for like
just,
2 seconds.
I guess I didn't see
it. No, I can't figure this out.
I didn't. Well, I was trying to concentrate on the podcast.
I'm just giving you crap. It's fine. I'm just giving you crap.
And also,
but no, that's good.
I do that intentionally somewhat. I deliberately dumb myself down. Now, I'm serious here. When I'm using user interfaces to try to perceive what they're like for a regular person, not a super genius like me, I have to try to slow down my brain, not read any of the text that appears, just to sort of, you know, just poke at the random boxes and try typing in them, all kinds of things. Like, I don't know, I'll put my email address. Let's try my email password. It's like, no, you're signing up. You're making up a password now. Oh, I think a lot of people don't get the difference between providing a password to sign up for. All right, who's playing Friday in the office? Oh, it's our doorbell. It's the doorbell to the Stack Exchange office. That's it. I think Jeff is right about working from home. I give up. Oh, look, there's a Shiba Inu taking a crap in the corner. Oh, no. Never mind. Okay.
Okay, so we covered that.
I'm sorry.
Any luck getting Steve?
Alex has put puppies up on the Ustream, and I can't. Turn off the puppies. It's just too distracting.
They're like cracked, Joel. You can't show puppies to Joel.
He just yawned. That's adorable. Stack Exchange logo. What were we even talking about?
Well, we had just finished talking about the provider.
Okay.
The one other thing I can talk about that I've been meaning to blog about, but I haven't gotten to, is that we did change it so the downvotes don't actually cost you any reputation anymore.
Because we wanted to.
Yeah, well, we wanted to encourage more voting, just more voting in general. But I think there are a class of questions, particularly on, not so much on the smaller sites, but well, it depends. I mean,
it should be.
The thing is, if questions come in and they're really not good, I mean, to the point where somebody really just didn't even try, they kind of need to be downvoted, because we lose our ability to discriminate between good and bad questions because there's simply not enough voting on questions.
Is that really going to change it, the fact that you don't lose? Well, you used to have to pay 1 point to downvote.
I know, it seems really tiny, but, like, there are so many users. I've been told so many times by users who have, like, 10,000 plus rep that, like, I can't
downvote.
They don't
want to downvote.
That'll cost me one rep. And I'm like, I don't even understand how to process that statement. That makes no sense to me, but...
I was so proud of that feature because it was like the feature you always dreamed of in New York City, which is you can honk as much as you want. It's just $5 each time. Honking will be allowed, but you have to pay for it, and you'll do it if it's going to save a chicken's life who is trying to cross the road. But you're not going to do it.
It's on questions only. First of all, we're not going to change that for answers.
That's a good one. Okay.
Yeah, it's only questions.
Okay, so you can downvote questions freely. Go ahead, go crazy, you guys. Let's downvote some bad questions. Yay.
Yeah, or upvote good ones. You know, just
that would be
works.
Even better.
I mean, we also, you can actually cast up to 40 votes now, of which 10 have to be questions. So we actually increase your daily voting quota as long as you actually vote on some questions. So
yeah.
Every question vote you cast is sort of a free bonus vote up to 10, and then you got your 30. Answer votes.
I hate to quote Gordon Bing one more time, but he actually said that if you have a system of points in your game, that you should also show lifetime earned points, like a monotonically increasing number, even if there's a way of losing them or spending them. Bing Gordon. Did I not say Bing Gordon?
You said Gordon Bing.
Really?
Yeah. Gordon Bing.
Gordon sounds like a first name.
It does.
I'm sorry. Bing Gordon. Former president of let's just, you're going to edit that out in post-production. You just rearrange the words, right? He said you should have monotonically increasing points. That's something the airlines learned with their frequent flyer miles, because you would earn 20,000 frequent flyer miles, and then you would spend them down to get a free ticket, and then you'd be looking at your account, and it would be like zero, and you'd feel like a big loser, even though you've already flown 20,000 miles on that airline. So now the airlines, every time they tell you your frequent flyer mileage, right next to it, it says lifetime earned miles and the total number of miles that you've learned in monotonically increasing form. So that might be kind of a neat thing we could do on Stack Overflow somewhere in the profile. Basically, even if you spent points on a bounty, we'll still tell you how many you've earned total ever.
We don't see that much bounty activity. So in general,
doesn't
that is
matter.
True.
Well, I mean, maybe that's the reason. Maybe if you didn't feel like, maybe more people would be willing to give a bounty if they felt like it wasn't decreasing their lifetime reputation. It was just decreasing their balance.
Yeah, it's possible. I think we're pretty close to that as is, because bounties are kind of a niche thing regardless. I mean, even if you made bounties, I don't want to say free, because that would be crazy, but if you reduce the cost dramatically, I'm not sure they would get used that much, because it just, you have to really care a lot, and you have to put in some effort to start the bounty and follow up on the bounty. It's kind of like having an eBay auction, really.
In the chat room, Moshberm says, bounties feel expensive. I don't know why. Why do they feel expensive? I guess it's because you're used to dealing in tens and twenties of points, and the bounties are like 100, 200, 300.
No, the bounties can be as low as 50, but I think the lowest bounty is 50, so yeah. That's true. It's a fairly large chunk. It's really just a tool. You know, when we came up with bounties, there were two goals. One is to get more questions answered, obviously, and the second was, once you have a lot of rep, it's like, what do you do with it? You can't spend it. I mean, you have this large number.
Yeah.
You want to use it to, you become Bill Gates, right? You have all this money, or Mark Zuckerberg, or whoever.
Yeah.
And you want to fix the world. It's like, oh, look, a question that I really like, I would like to see an answer. Blam, slap a bounty on it. You don't even have to think about it, right, because you have so much rep. But like you said, we have users with 20,000 rep that agonize over every downvote because they lose one rep. So maybe, you're right, that's another reason they don't, you know, use the bounty system as much as they should.
Lifetime rep. Maybe we just have lifetime reputation so they don't feel bad. There's another phenomenon which the airlines figured out a little bit too late. The phenomenon is that it takes you just as long to go from 10,000 to 20,000 as it took you to go from 0 to 10,000. But the entire time you're going from 10,000 to 20,000, your reputation number starts with a digit 1. So basically, your experience is you go 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000, 9,000, 10,000.
So,
and
you
then
basically
there's a pause for that long.
1,000.
Well, what the airlines started doing is they started giving you... like 50% bonuses for being above a certain point, which is totally bizarre. We got puppies again on the screen. Damn it, Alex. The puppy peed in the corner, and mommy is cleaning up. That's adorable. And the advertisement says, train any dog in 6 days. This is just infinitely distracting to have Shiba Inu puppies in the corner on the screen when we're doing our podcast. I think we might have to go to a picture of the Stack Overflow office or something like that, just to kind of random.
I think you have to avert your eyes.
I don't even know what we were talking about anymore. Oh, so because of that syndrome that you start to feel like you're stuck forever with your first digit being one, you almost want people to get like an accelerant, which says, you know, you earn a reputation at twice as fast once you get past 10,000. And it doesn't mean anything. It just means that the people above 10,000 have their bounty sort of, or have their reputation spread across a wider field. You know, they're like only using the even numbers instead of the odd and the even numbers. But it does cause that sort of psychological feeling of making progress, not to slow down so much when you hit the mystical 10,000.
Well, we kind of do that because you get a lot of reputation, a lot of privileges early in the system, very early.
I mean, yeah.
For, you know, once you get to 2,000, 3,000 rep, there's like, it's kind of a wasteland. You got to get to 10,000, right?
Well, that's another thing. When you used to get to 10,000, it just starts to get boringer and boringer.
Well, no, there's a 20,000 thing now. Anyway, where was I going with that?
I don't know.
I can't remember.
This has been a great podcast.
Oh, well, I was hoping we could get Steve. I really did want to talk to him, but I'm looking
we might have to get him next week.
Get him.
Yeah, I think we'll just have to bring him on next week.
Producer Alex says next week. We've also got, I want to get Dave Weiner.
What about Dave Weiner? Didn't you?
We had lunch with him today. He's agreed to be on the show, so we'll get him on a future episode. I didn't want to, he's an interesting guy, and he's mellowed out a little bit over the years, so. That will be a good podcast. Also in the queue, Jason Calacanis. we got, I finally figured out Rory's new email address. He's changed it. It's no longer Rory at Neapolitan, Neapoli, whatever. So we'll get Rory on. We'll get a lot of good guests in the queue.
What about that guy you guys are always talking about, the bingo card guy?
Oh, yeah, we get Patrick McKenzie. Sure, we get him. He's in Japan.
Yeah, he sounds interesting.
Yeah, he's those of you from home know him as Patio 11 on the Hacker News.
Yes, I know him as Bingo Card Creator guy.
Bingo Card Creator. He's he made a little bit of money writing the world's best bingo card creator and just making an amazing website for it, and I like optimizing everything about his funnel so as to sell a lot of bingo cards. But now he's realizing that he can do about 1 hour of funnel optimization consulting and make as much money as he makes in a year selling the bingo cards to school teachers. So so now he's a funnel optimization consultant.
Based on his years of experience selling bingo cards. But no, that's actually valid because I thought the story was much more interesting than the actual product. I was like, okay, bingo cards, who cares?
Yeah.
But like his thinking behind it was really fun to follow and like just the story. Mm-hmm. This is classic storytelling, really.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the topic didn't really matter.
Unlike our podcast, there are stories that it's interesting. I got to think of a story to tell. Oh, wait. I have a story.
Okay, tell it.
Okay, we are going to start hiring like a community team. We already have a community team. We have a community team that I think of sort of as an inside community team, meaning they handle the existing communities. And we want to start hiring kind of an outbound community team to kind of evangelize the Stack Exchanges a little bit more, and also to basically provide logistical and administrative support for the limited community team that we have and for the members of the Stack Exchange sites. I don't know if I'm describing this well, but if you want to see the full details, you can go to the Stack Exchange site, click on about stackexchange.com and click on the about link and there's a we're hiring button on there and you can see all the open positions that we have, and this one is called community evangelism team, and it's going to be a team, we're going to call them Chaos, Chaos, based on Get Smart, of course, not the current TV show named Chaos but the old Get Smart, and which is awful, by the way. Chaos with a K, yeah. Jason says it should be a K.
K-A-O-S.
He's like, I know American Sign Language, and the K C H C. Well, the C is for community, H is for help team, all one word. I know that's not a word, but I like it being help team, helping, K community helping, no, community help team and organizational support. And they're going to provide support for the communities who need helping. And it's really hard to describe. It's the perfect job for a humanities major that just graduated from college and wants to be bossed around and be told, send this to here and call that guy and make this thing happen and arrange for that and so forth. Is that a good description? That was a terrible description. So so we put out the job description, which is pretty detailed and pretty complicated and pretty extensive. It's sort of, you know what it is? We wanted this job to be for all the kind of people who have a very nice liberal arts degree and have found that it is completely useless and are now looking at a lifetime of entry-level work in a public relations firm, you know, sending stupid spam to journalists and stuff like that. And instead of doing that, come join us and help us make the Stack Exchange awesome and great. We started we got a bunch of applications. We're going through this sort of process of giving them a really, really easy internet aptitude test of some sort of like a 15-minute SAT test that's just sort of first level screening.
Wait, Joel, hold on. I got it. This could be like our own Mechanical Turk. We could pretend to want to hire all these people and tell them, hey, all you got to do is go ask a question on the Stack Exchange site or answer a question.
So we can see if you deserve a job.
Exactly. And then we end up with all these great questions. Actually, they probably wouldn't be great.
No, they're not allowed to ask questions. They're basically going to follow the what I've previously described as the Betsy Weber School of Public Relations, which is that you are not allowed to ask anybody for anything ever under any circumstance, ever. You are only to offer things. You could give people things. You can help people with things. You can help people with their problems. You can send them stuff. If you find out that they have a dog, you can send them biscuits. But you can't ever ask anybody for anything. That's my Joel's law of public relations.
Right.
It's going to be fun.
Well, I do think one thing you're not really mentioning that I think is kind of important is this idea that you're actually a good communicator. If you have a humanities degree,
absolutely,
you know how to write, you know how to communicate, you can actually interact with other human beings in a way that they can actually understand.
Right.
Programmers not always so good at.
Right. Part of the filter for this, I mean, I don't think any programmers will apply for this. You know, part of the filter is going to be there's going to be a little test where you got to sit down and you got to write, you know, 10 emails, you know, and we're going to describe circumstances and you're going to have to basically dash off very quickly a one paragraph, well-written, you know, friendly but stern email to deal with 10 situations. And, you know, part of the test will be kind of judging how well you deal with that situation. Part of the test will be, you know, judging how well you write and just sort of how well you deal with those kind of things. And I think we have about a billion ideas here. You know, the classic example, the closest idea probably the most successful thing we've done in this area is sending out free games to users on gaming.stackexchange.com so that they can, you know, try them out and write about them maybe. And that's the kind of thing we want to do times 50. Like, we want to do this on 50 sites in the Stack Exchange network, not just one. So that's why we're putting together a team that will have nothing else to do all day but this. So if you or anyone you know is a humanities major, you want to help with community development, you want to learn about evangelism, the new way, the 21st century way.
This is logistically a New York position, though, the one you're describing.
This one is in New York. Yeah, we are always hiring remote people as well, so don't hesitate to apply for other jobs, but this particular one is going to be a team here in New York, and producer Alex is getting very excited about building a gigantic video wall that we're going to use to keep track of all our stuff. We got 5 flat screen TVs on order, which will be arranged in portrait mode right next to each other to make the world's largest video, well, not the world's largest, but our office will have this big gigantic video wall that we use to keep track of everything that the evangelism team is doing, so we can just sort of glance up there and say, all right, this week we're promoting this.
Right.
And here's who's doing what and that kind of stuff, and little charts that will go up and go down, and possibly even a video of Shiba Inu puppies.
They're being adorable right now.
Oh, are they on? Which tab is this in?
Yeah,
I can't see it. Throw it up. They're being adorable right now. Here's a question. I'm going to take a question from the audience. Can Joel explain why he doesn't think that great programmers are not to be found developing internal company apps? Yay, puppies. Okay. I think the question, there were too many negatives in there. Why aren't the great programmers developing internal company apps? You know, I wouldn't really say it that way. What I would say is that internal company apps are just not that interesting. And so to the extent that programmers feel like they have a choice of where to work, they're unlikely to be interested by internal corporate apps. they're much more likely to be interested by the kinds of things that are going to influence and affect a lot of people. They would rather work on a Twitter client or something that allows people to see puppies from their own home than work on a thing which, you know, handles the sales tax reconciliation project internally at a company that they may or may not care about. It's not 100% true. It's just a generalization. And in general, the better programmers are and the more they realize they're good, the more marketable their skills are, the more choices they have and where to work, and the less likely they are to pick that job at a corporation doing something internal. The one big exception is outside of major cities where there are product jobs available. So if you're in a little town somewhere and really the only programming job available is at the big sawmill, then go ahead, take that programming job at the sawmill. But that is my explanation.
Hey, Joel, I should point out that we also have a Stack Exchange chat room for this. Chat.stackexchange.com.
Oh, boy.
/rooms/512. It's a good number. It's 512.
But no puppies. Wait a minute. I'm about to get an I'm getting an advertisement for insulin being broadcast to me through the Ustream. All right.
I like the idea of us taking questions. Let me go into the Stack Exchange room and see if they have questions.
Okay. People in the Stack Exchange room, this is your chance to ask Jeff a question.
Yeah.
All the people saying no sound are referring to the puppies, right?
Yeah. It was on puppies, there was no sound. It's fixed now. If you want to go back to puppies, there will be sound now.
Oh, but the puppies don't have sound. That's the whole point.
Right, but it'll be our sound over the puppies.
Oh, that's what we wanted.
Yeah, here. See, now there should be our sound over the puppies. Oh, my God.
Yeah, really, puppies are pretty extremely cute. All right, well, we apologize for the loss of the sound while we had the puppies.
So I'm asking in the chat room, they're like, oh yeah, we probably should have been thinking up questions in this chat room rather than randomly chatting.
Well,
also,
we should have been
go on record as being anti-puppy now. I'm like, and this is just
okay,
too much of a distraction.
Got the puppies. Yeah, that is a distraction. We're learning how to do this. I think what we'll do is we'll have a video of me talking. Can we feed a video of Jeff?
You really don't want to do that. That would be a bad idea.
We'll figure out some awesome cool stuff. Let's have video of you and Jeff and maybe a screen that you can show things on.
We could basically have, if we just had alternating between me just sitting here talking with the Stack Exchange office in the background, you know, people walking into the kitchen, getting food and going out to the ping pong table and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
That'll be the background.
You know, Joel, have you mentioned the math.stackexchange intern? I think we might have mentioned him before.
Oh, yeah.
But as far as, like, stats, this wall of stats that you're talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He could do
that might be a good thing for him to think about.
Yeah. Well, he's got to find, in general, he's got to find metrics that we should be measuring. Measuring? Jason nods. Measuring. This is, you know, it's so much better doing a podcast here with the chat room and the live audience of one. And because, you know, I don't have to know the answer to everything. I can get Jason here, American Sign Language, giving me the answers.
Jason Punyon?
Yeah, it is the Punyon.
Ooh,
once
we get the giant monitor wall set up, we
yeah.
just have you sit against it and use that as like the
That'll backdrop. Be a very cool backdrop. That's right. But not as many people crossing by in the background. We've got to figure out a way that people will have to cross by behind me to get somewhere.
Yeah. You're required to go past behind Joel at least once an hour during the podcast.
That's right. People will be requested to walk behind me on the podcast.
We actually have an on-topic question finally, Joel.
Yes,
about
good.
German.stackexchange.
Excellent question. The answer is we've pretty much forgotten the war over here. It was a long time ago and sorry, it's a faulty tower joke.
Yes. So, honestly, to be honest with you, I haven't even looked at the site, so I'm not even the right person to ask. But Robert Arcato,
right,
who has looked at it extensively, is very pleased with how the site is going, which I trust completely. So,
does he know
I've
German?
Been reassured that it's going really well. My only opinion on these language sites is you have to realize they're not – it's for people who know English learning language X. Okay, so it's still kind of a baby step for us into localization, meaning the site is intended for people who know English and also want to learn X, where X is Japanese and German. And we don't just have German, we also have Japanese, which I think started today.
Yeah, it did. It's a private beta today, yep. I know that you're saying it's supposed to be for people who are in English learning German, but looking at it right now on the German site, I would say 75% of the questions are 100% German.
Well, baby steps is my only point. I don't have really strong feelings about it. I just
maybe teenage, you know, steps. That's how. I mean, this is how you learn another language. Like, if you went to a German class at a university right now, even a absolute beginning German class, absolute beginning, the class would be conducted in German, even though you are an absolute beginner and you don't understand a word of it, because that's just considered best practice for language teaching is total immersion.
I don't think this is that different from the experiments that are code review, which is an experiment.
Mm-hmm.
Programming puzzles and code golf, that's also an experiment.
Yep.
And, you know, we've said many times we're not afraid to try things that the community is telling us they want to try. And then, you know, if it's not working, stop it.
Right.
But I think it's way too early to tell if it's going to work. But I do think there's enough of a mixture of English and German that it's not sort of... The problem site where we can't tell anything what's going on unless we have a German speaker on staff, which we actually do. I mean, Ben Dumke obviously speaks German.
Yeah.
I hope.
The meta is all in English here. So that's very interesting that the meta is in a different language. And that's, you know, part
well,
of
that's
that.
That's good. That was one of my concerns was, like, I can't see what's going on meta. I need to see the meta. That's how I can tell. That's one of the major ways we look at the health of a site is, what does your meta look like?
Yeah.
Is it dead?
Well, that's we could tell. I mean, we could tell from... statistically, even if the meta here were in a language we didn't know, we would know statistically that the meta is alive. We just would have to get translations to make sure that you know, to make sure people were behaving. But that's something that's very, very easy for us to do, even if we didn't have a German speaker on staff. In fact, we can set that up for Japanese next week. It's just get a service to translate the, you know, occasionally stuff that we...
Well, Robert said he was doing that. On some of them where he couldn't read it, he would paste it into Google Translate.
Yeah, and that's not so bad, yeah.
We had another question, which is about, we have a lot of upcoming sites. Gardening just went.
Yeah, 100%. Everything sped up all of a sudden. Why did that happen?
Well, we started advertising proposals that are over 50%.
As opposed
to all
that
proposals. Effect.
Yeah.
I'm trying to see what else we got here. Philosophy? Astronomy? Wow. Astronomy, philosophy, and gardening and landscaping. So we just, German's been around a little while. That'll come out to public beta soon. Japanese just started today, and then I think we're doing another one this week, probably astronomy or philosophy. We're doing two per week until we catch up.
Awesome. Yay. Yeah. Growth again.
Well, you know, I think there was a little bit of a lull that let us catch up. Jin had certainly plenty of work to do.
Right.
So we'll see. I mean, I don't know if I want one site for every human language. It's like German, Japanese. I mean, do we want that, Joel?
I don't think
we would have that, though. I mean, you've always made the point that there's only like five languages that are sort of big enough.
In IT,
our audience. That's right, in our audience.
Yeah. There are 10 languages probably that cover a big chunk of the world's population. But in IT, it's a smaller number. There were actually, in the five that I was talking about, were the languages that I would want for programming questions in those languages. And those were German, Japanese, Korean, Chinese, and Spanish in the first round. Second round, maybe French, Italian.
You know, that is curious that Japanese and German were the two to go. That is interesting. I wonder why that is.
Because they have gigantic populations of programmers.
Yeah. Their Spanish is at like... Geez, not even 25%.
Yeah, not 23%. Nearly as many. Not nearly as many programmers, though.
Yeah.
But Spanish is one of the big ones. It's one of the big five. The big five that I mentioned. Those are the languages that MSDN, basically the Microsoft documentation, is 100% translated, down to the smallest, you know, item is always translated in those languages. And every other language, they only have some of the documentation translated. You know, sort of based on demand or need. Those five, they translate every word automatically.
Wow, it looks like the personal productivity is going to go next, the getting things done.
Oh, no. But there's only going to be one question, and the question is going to be, how can I get more stuff done? And the answer is going to be, get off the site and go do something that you care about instead of talking about the meta of. That was why I was very pleased that Merlin Mann gave up on his website, which was like the obsessive over personal productivity website that he had.
Right.
It was just like, you can it's the biggest procrastination in the world, right? Make a website about getting things done. It's like almost hilarious. But I know, personal productivity, very important to people, and they'll have a lot of fun with that. I mean, that site, lifehacker.com, which is, I guess, on this subject, is one of the biggest blogs of all time. It's huge.
Yeah, it's a big topic. And I mean, there is some argument to be made that our engine sort of help people focus, you know, because we are, I hate to say it this way, but, you know, sometimes I have to explain that, like, look, you know, we're not really here to sort of be very touchy-feely friendly with you. We're here to produce, like, useful information. To the extent that you agree with us on that, then fantastic. Come along with us on this journey. But part of that is ruling out this social stuff that tends to, particularly the productivity, you could see where that would be really toxic. You know, it's bad enough that you're talking about productivity all the time, but if it's productivity and it's like, what's your favorite
right, sure.
way to organize your multi-
your to-do your list. It's always your to-do list. You're always organizing a to-do list. Yeah, stop already. Well, maybe they'll come up with something useful and helpful and interesting. The trouble is the questions.
No, it's an experiment. I just wanted to point it out that it's coming up. I know our friend Lowell, How to Geek, was always ranting about this. Like, this was one of his pet topics. Like, how much it drove him crazy, all the, like, personal productivity sites and, like, just how weird those communities got. Mm-hmm. In fact, I might ping him after this call, just let him know this is coming up and what should we do to avoid sort of the major problems with a productivity site, because I'm sure he has a lot of opinions. He's actually been very helpful. He's emailed me a couple times about stuff we've been doing. And so I'll just plug his site, you know, howtogeek.com. He's got a network of sites as well that he runs. And,
right.
You know, friend of the network.
Friend of the network. Like, there are cousins in the League of Terminal Justice.
Very, very, very smart guy. Some other questions. How will you prioritize who gets chaos help?
I think the way
to look at this is like, go to the meta of a particular site and see how many proposals they have for things that we could sort of assist with. Like, let me give you an example of a good one that came up recently is on board games. On boardgames.stackexchange, they had a really neat plan for getting like new board games to community members to just review them and talk about them and create traffic in the community. And this is win-win because the community gets board games, which is awesome. It's a board game community. And then it's a win from our perspective because we're just unlocking what they want to do anyway. We're not telling them what to do. They're telling us. So if you want chaos help, you need to be on your meta, like, you know,
suggesting
topics, saying, hey, we need Stack Exchange Inc. to help us do this and have like some kind of plan.
We have, and I just want to give people ideas that reflect the kind of ideas we've had. There is the board games, there's video games on gaming.stackexchange. We didn't want to actually get people cameras on photography because they're kind of expensive, but we will have a lending library of high-end cameras and lenses that people may want to check out for a week or two just to try them out, take some pictures, you know, answer questions, ask questions, etc. So there's stuff that we can do even on some of the surprisingly expensive sites like photography where we can do something that's more reasonable, like, you know, have a few of whatever the top-of-the-line cameras are that you wish you could try out, make them available. What are some of the other sites? There's just so much stuff that we can do, and the more ideas that we get. Again, we're looking to – we have funds available. We don't have ridiculous funds. We're not going to be flying people out to the Nikon factory and giving them one of every camera. However, we can have a couple of high-end cameras in stock, which we rotate.
Yeah, that's a great plan. And I think that covers sort of like equipment rental where it's like something expensive. I mean, if it's a $60 game, then we're happy to seed the community with games so that they can talk about them and play them.
Yep.
But obviously, we're not going to seed the community with $50,000 high-speed cameras. But one idea I really liked, and I don't know how applicable to photo this is, so maybe the photo people can tell me, is that really high-speed camera. Is that even considered photography at that point? But anyway, all those videos you're seeing of people with these high-def cameras.
Right.
That they can produce like, you know, 100 frames per second, and just seeing everything in like super slow motion, like puppies running. I said puppies.
Puppies.
Joel, this is for you. I know. You're like, you're off in space now. You're like, what?
Lasovic in the chat room says, think of the puppy movies you can make with a high-speed camera.
Exactly. So stuff like that, because I would love to see what the community produces with stuff like that. Like on photography, the photo of the week, that Jin totally set that up all by himself, by the way, is awesome. Like, I love going there and seeing the amazing things that this community has produced.
Ooh, we need that on our video wall. Photo of the week. Yeah. Alex, let's make it six. Portrait. Plasma TVs.
Well, that gets a little complex because then we have to add in more truss pieces. Like right
more truss. All right, fine. Five. Throw photo.stackexchange up on the chat, up on the Ustream just for kicks. Just to test our ability to throw a website up on the chat room. Bacon gin.
So this was a long answer to, you know, how will we prioritize who gets chaos help? The communities will, because there if is. You're on the meta producing interesting, actionable things that we can help logistically with, we will certainly make that happen. But if your meta is dead or there's not a lot of activity, then there's not much to work with.
What is that, a photograph? Oh, it looks like Niagara Falls. No?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, it's Niagara.
Niagara Falls. That's Jin's photo. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. There are some communities where there's not any real obvious thing that we can do other than just try to, you know, gently encourage people to, you know, I mean, there isn't, we're not the chaos team, just to make it clear, is not a go shopping and buy nifty things and throw them at the community team. Although sometimes that may be the right strategy, but a lot of times the strategy is just going to be, you know, spreading the word and love and helping people get organized. Maybe board game people want to get together in cities and have board game sessions. We have one actually at Fog Creek every week, so we could open that up a little bit and you know, pay for pizza or something like that.
And also conference sponsorships. Yep. There's really three things we do. We will sponsor conferences as an entity, like Stack Exchange Inc. sponsors the, you know, coffee conference.
Right.
We will send people to go to conferences.
Yep.
If you're a member in good standing in the community, and we'll agree to sort of share what your experience at the conference, we will do that. We obviously encourage people to speak at the conferences. That's the big one, if mm-hmm. you can. But that's also available to communities. In fact, a lot of the communities have threads on that already that I started a while back.
Yep.
So that's another thing that we're happy to facilitate with, and the Chaos team would definitely be working on.
All right. Well, we're starting to run out of time. So this week was a little bit of a weird podcast because we thought we were going to have a guest, and then that didn't quite work out, but that will happen
sometime. Maybe next week.
Maybe next week. And we're experimenting for the first time with the chat room / Ustream thing, which I think was good. We got a couple of live listener questions. I think that it does make a lot of difference to just have, you know, 100 people watching us record. Those of you that are listening now, we tend to record these shows every Tuesday at about 4 o'clock, and we'll get more organized about it in the future, about announcing exactly what time and where, but you can also just follow me on Twitter at Spolsky, and I'll tweet right before we record a show, and then you can dive in and watch us recording it. We had about 85 people in the live audience right now. We only have 35 odd employees in the entire Stack Exchange, so there must be at least 50, and then there's my dad, so there must be at least 49 anonymous people here that actually care enough about this podcast to listen to it live. So thank you to the 49 real people. Any other plugs this week, announcements? No.
No, I think we covered all the big ones.
All right. See you next week.
See you next week.